All right, well, it's 4 p.m. We'll go ahead and get started. Thank you for joining our clubhouse today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society's Senior Fellow, Rob Trzynski, on why we keep government out of the culture war. We encourage people to ask questions. So, as Rob is presenting his ideas, if you have comments or questions, raise your hand, we'll bring you up. I quickly want to encourage people to sign up for the Atlas Society's weekly newsletter, which has some great content. I'll put up a link as we get started. Rob, thanks for doing this topic today. So, why should we keep government out of the culture wars?
All right. So, I was just mentioning to Scott before we started that I set this topic up like a month ago as the topic for today's clubhouse. And by coincidence, it just happens to be this is what I'm writing a whole article on this today because it came up just in the last week, late last week. The New York Times had an editorial. I mean, this is like an editorial put out by its editorial board, not an op-ed by a guest. This is the New York Times editorial board talking about the problem of cancel culture and the problem of threats to free speech. And it was, it's some kind of victory that we got the New York Times of all places to go out and take a stand on this. And let me just read the first couple paragraphs. I think it's actually there's a few little nitpicks here and there, but it's actually quite good. So it's the first three paragraphs. For all the tolerance and enlightenment that modern society claims, Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country. The right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned. This social silencing, this depluralizing of America, has been evident for years, but dealing with it stirs yet more fear. It feels like a third rail, dangerous. For a strong nation and open society, that is dangerous. How has this happened? In large part, it's because the political left and right are caught in a destructive loop of condemnation and recrimination around cancel culture. Many on the left refuse to acknowledge that cancel culture exists at all, believing that those who complain about it are offering cover for bigots to peddle hate speech. Many on the right, for all their braying about cancel culture, have embraced an even more extreme version of censoriousness as a bulwark against a rapidly changing society, with laws that would ban books, stifle teachers, and discourage open discussions in classrooms. All right, so that's, and you can go read the rest of it. It's made the rounds a lot and gotten a lot of discussion. Now, the big thing that the left has come up against with this as a response to this is they're outraged, absolutely outraged at the both sidesism and moral equivalence here. How can you say that, the minor criticisms of people being offered by the left or anything like the censorship being proposed by the right? And they have done exactly what this editorial predicted they would do, which is refuse to acknowledge cancel culture exists at all. Now, by coincidence, that editorial went up last week at about the same time that went up. My local college town, the Cavalier Daily, the student newspaper for the University of Virginia, had a lead editorial, "Dangerous Rhetoric is Not Entitled to a Platform," and saying that hateful rhetoric is violent and this is impermissible. This is an editorial, again, signed, this is the editorial board of the Cavalier Daily, somewhat less exalted than the New York Times. Saying that diversity of thought is a pathetic excuse, hateful rhetoric should not be permitted on campus, and I think what they're trying to do specifically is prevent Mike Pence, former Vice President Mike Pence, from being able to speak on campus. All right, so here you have, and the whole thing is just amazing. It's everything every caricature of cancel culture that's out there is fully embodied. All the worst characters we can come up with are fully embodied in this editorial in the Cavalier Daily. So there you have people saying, "Oh, cancel culture doesn't exist." At the same moment that a sterling example of cancel culture comes rolling across rolling across the internet to us. All right. So now, what I want to talk about though is the more of the other side. So people on the right would probably, if I know the people on the right, there's probably a lot of them that are upset with the New York Times for saying that the right is doing this, that the right is banning books and all that sort of thing. And they say, no, we're not, we're just, we should we should have our politicians be able to do something just to stop. We're just fighting back against this, you know, woke conformity being imposed upon us. And we're just in bringing the government in to help us out, because this is such a powerful force that we need somebody on our side. So if we can get, you know, politicians to come in and pass legislation that will help provide us some backstop, some support against cancel culture, that's not really censorship. That's not us trying to impose our ideas. That's us just sort of trying to fight back. But I think the New York Times has an excellent point. Now, I'm going to give a couple examples here. So I had that example of the cancel culture from the University of Virginia student newspaper. There's a couple other really interesting examples of this sort of thing going around out there. But I think you've probably all heard that. But the example I'm looking at is in Texas. So there's been a number of laws being passed on the state level that are dictating what can be taught in the elementary schools. And you might think, okay, there's a certain excuse there because these are elementary schools, these are kids. The government usually sets a specific curriculum and certain standards for the curriculum for what's taught in the public schools. Now, personally, I think, and we'll get to this later, but I think there's I think that's a great argument for not having public schools in the first place, that they get to set what's in the curriculum and what gets taught and have all these standards and guidelines for, oh, you will teach this and you won't teach that. That's an excellent reason not to have the government involved in the schools in the first place. It's an excellent argument for school choice. But the excuse here has been, and I've seen people like Chris Rufo make this excuse that, well, actually, you know, this has been litigated in the courts. And, you know, they said the government, because the government runs the schools, it has a right to, set standards for what's in the curriculum and what's not. Well, they're going beyond that now. Latest thing is Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Now, this is a guy who's been making a lot of anti-woke noises. He's clearly a very ambitious guy who wants to get a lot of attention and rise to higher office. And he was out on Twitter saying, I quote, "I will not stand by and let loony Marxist University of Texas professors poison the minds of young students with critical race theory. We banned it in publicly funded K through 12, and we will ban it in publicly funded higher ed." So there you see that having set the precedents that we can dictate what's taught in the primary and secondary schools. Now he's saying we're going to dictate what's taught in higher ed and make higher ed answer to, you know, the public universities answer to the higher authorities who are running it in the state. Another example is one being proposed in Florida. I think it's actually called the Stop Woke Act, which would ban not just classroom, but also corporate training that they consider woke indoctrinations of cultural guilt. So this is not just saying we're going to ban what happens in government-run schools and government-run classrooms. Now we're going to be telling private corporations, we're going to be telling Disney or Coca-Cola or whoever else is the sort of woke corporate bad guy at the moment, we're going to tell them what they can do in their training sessions. And then there's also the what's called the Don't Say Gay Act, or at least it's been successfully dubbed that by its opponents. You know, this is the game that politicians play, of course. You know, they named it the Parental Choice Act because, of course, they want to say, oh, this is just about parental choice. And, of course, you know, that's sort of a tendentious description of the bill. So, of course, the game is the other side comes and gives their own tendentious description of it, which is the Don't Say Gay bill. But the idea here is this is saying that, you know, you can't, originally it said you can't have classroom discussion. The teachers can't engage in classroom discussion that mentions homosexuality in certain age range, below a certain age range. And the discussion part was so overly broad that they were then forced to narrow it down and say they can't have classroom instruction on that at that age, which sounds somewhat more reasonable. The unreasonable part, as I see it, of the act is that it is the enforcement mechanism for it, which is it's this new thing that Republicans have started to really embrace and seem to really like, which is that you as the parent can go basically inform on a teacher that you think is doing this and have your own sort of lawsuit that you and a prosecution that you initiate. So, you know, typically in our justice system, a prosecution of somebody for violating the law would be initiated by an officer of the government who would exercise prosecutorial discretion. there would be a first round of saying, the prosecutor has to decide, yes, this really is a crime. We should be moving ahead on it. Giving private citizens the ability to initiate a prosecution, which, by the way, was the same system under which Socrates was prosecuted for corrupting the youth of Athens in ancient Greece. You know, that a private citizen can come along and make this complaint. It obviously invites a high degree of abuse. And I think it sort of meant, you know, that a rather vaguely stated description combined with an engine of litigation, private litigation to enforce it, sort of is meant to create this situation where the schools are so afraid of being sued that they preemptively clamp down on anything that might possibly run afoul or cause anybody to complain. So it is clearly intended that way. And the most disturbing part of that story, by the way, is that anybody who's against the bill has now been described as a, quote, groomer. And this is a reference to pedophiles. You know, one of the things pedophiles will do is they will engage in a long period of preparing a victim that they have in mind, preparing the victim to be abused. And so this is it's an old smear that all homosexuals are basically pedophiles. And so this idea that anybody who's in favor of, this is called an anti-grooming bill now by its proponents, and that anybody who's against this law restricting what can be said in the classroom is really just in favor of letting pedophiles groom children so they can molest them. It is a horrible old smear dredged up. And it gives you an idea for the sort of sense behind it, or the push behind it. So what I'm seeing here is that you have people on the right who are saying, oh, there's all this terrible wokeness out there. And instead of exposing it and arguing against it, and, you know, we've seen now that if you expose it and you argue against it, eventually you get the New York Times editorial board to come over on your side and say, yes, you've got a point. This is something we need to. Now, you know, it's a case of physician heal thyself. I think the New York Times editorial board needs to look to itself, because they've done plenty of censorious and canceling things to their own employees. The fact that is you can use persuasion and you can use, you know, expose this and actually change the momentum of this issue. And I think we actually have done so. But there's always the temptation to say, let's bring government in on our side. But when you bring government in on your side to protect you, just to pass laws against what corporations can say in their corporate training, for example, the obvious thing about that is you have to, you know, if you think three steps ahead, two or even one step ahead, is that what happens if, having set this precedent, that the government can go in and make very specific dictation about what's taught in the public schools, what's taught in the universities, public universities, what's taught in private corporate training, you're creating an enormous precedent that is ripe to be abused, first of all, by anybody who's farther to the right than you are. You know, so somebody could come in and say, you can't have you can't have atheist ideas expressed in classrooms, or atheist ideas expressed in universities, or atheist ideas expressed in corporate training. Or so, you know, you're opening yourself up to have exploited by somebody who is on a different, who's sort of quote unquote on your side, but actually on a different variation of your side and against your own ideology. Or, of course, you know, if control of government flips back to the Democrats, you're creating a precedent that somebody could come in and then dictate the opposite. That no, you can't have conservative ideas being proposed, or you can't have anti-homosexual ideas, you know, quote unquote homophobic ideas being taught, etc. So it really, what it does is that without a universal principle that allows for some degree of freedom of speech and tolerance of different ideas, without the government required to be neutral on the ideological content, that you're opening something where it's just a raw contest for power, and it's just a matter of who happens to have control of the levers of government, who happens to have the governor and a governor in office right now. And you can see how that creates this sort of constant, even more intensified culture war, where it's all about who can get their guy elected into office, and therefore, impose everything they possibly could want in terms of imposing their ideas even more so. You know, the cancel culture people right now are largely limited to, it's not a good thing. It's a bad thing on the cultural level, but they are to a large extent limited to cultural shunning. The getting people to voluntarily agree to submit to say, okay, I'm not going to talk to, or I'm not going to work with the person who says this, but it's not government action. It's getting the groupthink consensus and the mob to get together and do this. And that's why Twitter is so central to this whole thing, right? You have to, Twitter is your medium for communication to get the mob all agreed on their target and all working together. But they have to rely on sort of being able to get people into the conformity of private action. And that's what makes wokeness actually quite weak, because the minute the consensus or the cultural momentum moves against them, they won't be able to mobilize those mobs. And I think that's what we're just beginning to see with this New York Times editorial. But if you start saying, oh, we need government to come in on our side, you're actually giving the woke mobs an even better tool that they can use, a more effective tool that they can use when they get into power. So I think that's the short-sightedness of bringing government in on our side, is that for one thing, our side may end up meaning, well, the religious conservatives get to use it against us. And it also might mean, so it's not really our side, it's a different faction that we thought was on our side but hates us just as much. Or it might mean that the other side gets into power and they use it against us. So that's why I think we don't bring government in, despite the temptation, you do not bring government in on your side of the culture war. And I think this New York Times editorial is an example of how you don't need government. You can make headway simply by exposing and arguing and making the case against cancel culture and against and in favor of open debate. So that's my general presentation, but I want to open this up for opinions from all people on all different sides.
Yes, we want to invite people up for questions, and I'll be glad to bring you up on the stage if you raise your hand. We're going to get to Roger in just a moment. I just have a follow-up. I just, this is something I feel passionately about. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be cheek turners. There has to be something that we can do. I don't want to always be the one telling our side not to do anything.
Hey, I thought you'd be on the other side of this, Scott. That's why I was thinking before. Because we've gone back and forth right. A couple times in previous ones, so that's why I was looking forward to this discussion.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm not arguing for being a cheek turner, but one of the people who influenced me a lot on this, in terms of the specifics of this, how this works, is David French. And David French has been attacked by some of these sort of nationalist conservatives as, David Frenchism is literally this sort of weak-kneed, cheek-turning approach. Now, the funny thing is the people, attacking David French for being cheek-turners are all hardcore Christians. I'm like, aren't you supposed to be in favor of turning the other cheek? But let's leave that aside. Obviously, as objectivists, we are not in favor of turning the other cheek. So yes, you don't want to be weak, but here's the thing, in being strong, it's really the whole, almost like the whole social contract question of a free society, right? Because the point of a free society is that, and the point of having government and the an orderly government and the rule of law is that you're delegating your ability to use force in retaliation. You're delegating that to the government because you recognize that it's in the long term, it's better for everyone to have a neutral arbiter operating according to universal principles, right? And so instead of, instead of just an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which is the other biblical, the opposite biblical reference, instead of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, where somebody, somebody hits you and you hit them back, or somebody steals from you, so you steal from them back, and it's all just gang warfare, you realize it's better to have, if somebody steals from me, I go take him to court. And it's solved by a neutral arbiter according to universal principles, a general principle we set down that apply to everyone. And so we recognize that, the whole basis for a civilized society, the whole basis for a government is that that's better than than, you know, saying that, and that then that's not really turning the cheek. That is defending yourself through orderly means that are actually better for everyone in the long run. And I think we need to have a similar attitude. And like I said, David French influenced me on this, because David French spent a whole, his whole early career, like half of his early career, as a litigator on religious freedom and freedom of speech cases in the universities. And he talks about, I've interviewed him, and he's talked about how the whole time he was doing this, he was fighting so hard for the idea of public spaces as ideologically neutral spaces, like public libraries and universities, these public spaces, public universities, as ideologically neutral spaces, and doing so as a in order to defend religion and you know, in order to defend religious expression, in order to defend people who had religious ideas that were disapproved of by the people around them. And he says he fought so hard as a protection for freedom of speech to establish this idea of public spaces as ideologically neutral. And then, so he talks about the chagrin of then seeing a bunch of these people come along after he spent 20 years doing this, basically, to say, oh, no, that's weak, and that's turning the cheek, and we should turn public spaces into non-ideologically neutral ones. We should try to control the public spaces and use them to promote our ideology. And here he is, you know, he has years of experience as a litigator, realizing that if you make those spaces not ideologically neutral, then, you know, they're not going to be run by your side. They're not going to be run by the conservatives. They're not going to be run by religious people. They're going to end up being run by people who are going to use that lack of neutrality to persecute you. So I think that's part of the, so I go back to that argument about how, you know, having the police and having the courts and having things settled by universal laws and neutral arbiters is not turning the other cheek. It is protecting yourself through a system that will actually, by its procedures, offer you far more protection than if it's just a war of all against all. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
That's, I hear you. We, you know, I do want to bring some others in. Roger, do you have a comment for Rob?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, first of all, thank you for the topic. It's an interesting one. It seems to be something that everyone's dealing with and thinking about in different ways. And I think you put a lot of good thoughts out there. And it's similar to the way that I think about it. But I want to ask a question based on it. And first, a comment. I do think that we should remember that there's always going to be a dominant culture.
Mm-hmm.
And a dominant culture will then give rise. It will create the conditions that allow for subcultures to arise. And then every once in a while, a subculture will poke through and become the dominant culture. And what I think that we're having now is a very interesting set of circumstances that give rise to a response to what's happening in the culture today. And my question for you would be, with these conditions that have been laid out there, what do you think the opportunity is for a subculture that prides themselves on rational self-interest, defense of capitalism, things of that nature, to perhaps have a window of opportunity to be a subculture which has been extremely small, to maybe expand because there's a pushback against these conditions? What do you think of the objectivist subculture gaining more prominence because of these conditions?
Oh, that's a great question. Now, yeah, one thing I want to second there is, yes, the culture wars will always be with us. And it's not a matter of whether we have a culture war, because there's always going to be a dominant culture, and there's always going to be somebody who disagrees with that dominant culture and wants to change it, right? So, you know, in the 1400s, the culture war was the Catholic Church versus the Catholic Church in Rome versus the humanists in Florence. And there was all sorts of stuff, you know, circa 1500s, all sorts of stuff that was going on with that. And by the way, that observation leads me to what I think is my ultimate answer to the culture war, because I wrote something years ago about what would count as winning the culture war. And I raised this issue that, well, the culture war never really is you can win it on a specific issue, but that just means we go on to fighting about a different issue, because the culture wars are always going to be there. There's always going to be disagreement. But my view on it was that if you think about, you know, there being a culture war in Florence, in Italy in the 1400s, well, what was the result of that? Well, we produced all sorts of amazing art and architecture, and, you know, the Florentines built this ginormous dome on their cathedral that was bigger than any dome anybody had ever built. And then Rome turned around and said, well, we got to have a really big dome too. So they built a really ginormous dome on St. Peter's. And, you know, Michelangelo made all these amazing sculptures. And then the Pope said, well, we got to have Michelangelo come and do it. I've got the ceiling I need him to paint in the Sistine Chapel. And so, you know, if you think of the Renaissance as being one giant culture war, really, between humanism and traditional religion, the result was that people produced all sorts of amazing culture. And so that's my plan for how the culture war ends and how we win the culture war, is that my plan for how the culture war ends is that culture wins. That the ethos of the culture war should be that you go out and produce your best stuff to showcase your view of the world and bring people over to it. And then we'll go out and produce our best stuff to showcase how amazing our view of the world is and bring people over to it. And I think that's the spirit in which we should approach the culture war. So I'm going to write a book called Confessions of a Reluctant Culture Warrior. And that's going to be my basic theme, is that the way the culture war should end is that culture wins. But I think that's the spirit in which we should approach it. And I think that the big opportunity for objectivists in this environment is to offer, first of all, to offer that alternative, the idea of you should try to fight the culture war by producing culture, by producing ideas and art and literature and all the things that would actually make people interested in and inspired to come over to your viewpoint. And in doing that, to offer a third alternative in the culture wars, because I think it's actually, you know, you talk about it being a tiny little subculture, but that third alternative in the culture wars is really, I think, where the overwhelming majority of people, or certainly a majority of people, would really want to be. You know, they don't want to be, I have to agree rigidly with this person's dogma, or I have to agree rigidly with this person's dogma. So, you know, the woke type, there have been various attempts to quantify this, but the woke types are something like 8% of the population, right? The woke guys on the left. And the, I don't know how many of the sort of the Christian right, religious right types there are, but there's a lot less of them than there used to be 30, 40 years ago. I remember the moral majority. So there's less of them than there used to be. They can't be much more than 8% of the population. And that leaves us with like 85% of the population out there saying, you know, I don't want to have to agree dogmatically with either one of those sides. I'm looking for something more sensible and something that's presented in a more positive way. And I think that's the spirit in which we should take this as an opportunity. But it also means we got to be out there, you know, basically go out there and produce a positive vision of the future and of the kind of society you want to, what kind of culture and society you want to see.
Good stuff. Phil, do you have a question for Rob? If you're able to unmute yourself. Well, I tell you what, while you're figuring that out, we're going to go ahead and jump to Nina. Nina, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for letting me join the conversation. I want to make the case that arguments for limited government need to be a part of the solution here, because there's tremendous power coming from the federal bureaucracy that's weighing in on one side of the culture war. So the president, for example, issues executive order that's caused every agency to look at how to infuse what they're doing with equity principles. So if you look at, say, Department of Education as an example, and any language coming out of that agency, you're going to see terminology around words like equity, oppression, social emotional learning, structures of power in every discussion. So they're talking critical theory, critical pedagogy, whether they're saying it or not. And they're pushing out guidance and money to state education agencies. So, you know, we're not just up against an individual teacher with an agenda or even a school board with an agenda, but huge amounts of federal money. And the amounts are colossal in response to COVID and equity pouring through that department with strings attached for how that money gets used. And you're seeing, if you read like requests for proposals coming out of federal agencies, these concepts all the way through them, you know, impacting things like how data collection and analysis is done. There's emphasis on community engagement that's resulting in taxpayer money going to local activists. So there's a huge amount of federal power weighing in on the culture war. So this, my question is, you know, how to battle that? I think any solution's gonna have to address that. The government is a player right now, a big, powerful player.
I think there's a good point to that, and one of the more indirect ways in which that's happened, and the guy who pointed this out was Richard Hanania, who is a kind of a wacky guy, but he's really gone off the deep end since the he's sort of like pro-Russian on the whole Ukraine invasion thing. So he's a lot of kind of an odd guy. I don't really know if he comes from the right or liberal right or the liberal left from his original origins, but. But he did make a really interesting observation a while back about how even before all this equity and DEI stuff became the vogue, it's state and federal regulations that sort of created a massive HR bureaucracy at every corporation. You know, because there's so many different government rules and government regulations and things having to do with employment that everybody has to comply with. That instead of having, you know, just a couple of guys in accounting who process payroll, you suddenly had to have a massive bloated human resources department. And then once you've got that, you've got this whole enforcement mechanism, and you've got people who carve out whole careers of fiefdoms inside the corporation, whose job is basically how do we ride herd over employees and manage every aspect of their lives. And you get... Now, by the way, I've had experiences with the sort of runaway HR department within Objectivist organization, within an Objectivist organization, not this one, but another one in the past. And I see how the institutional structure is just there that pushes people into that sort of mindset. And that's sort of the infrastructure that was ripe to be mobilized for DEI as the latest, you know, as the latest fad as they go by. And yes, the government money going into that is very important, but I also want to say that, I think there are some things you can do, and I think there's a very worthwhile thing to do to campaign for restrictions on that. Now, the problem is you're going to have to deal with the fact that it doesn't just come from the laws. It doesn't just, or from the top guy, you know, you can't just replace an agency head. You have to, it comes from all throughout the bureaucracy, and you have sympathizers, you know, throughout the bureaucracy. I mean, sort of the, I hated the way that the word deep state was used, because it actually, it comes from a totally different context of a dictatorship where there's like a secret cabal running things, you know, an actual secret cabal running things behind the scenes. I didn't like the way the word deep state was used by Trump and his people. But there is such a thing as, you know, it's an old observation about the permanent bureaucracy in the federal government. And it's all these people in low-level positions who have a certain groupthink that, you know, they all come from roughly the same ideological background. They've got the same ideological bias, and they tend to promote whatever the thing is right now that everybody's supposed to agree with. And so it's very hard to change that. Now, my argument against Trump on that is he made a lot of noise about taming the federal bureaucracy, but he actually didn't make enough federal appointments to do that. So, you know, he didn't have, there were huge numbers of political appointees in the agencies that positions that were left unfilled. And so the process of reforming the bureaucracy and not having the federal bureaucracy there as this instrument to be used by whoever the president is, to promote whatever their latest ideological fad is, that is a huge process that needs to be done. And I think that's the process we need to do. And so my model for this actually is the issue of public schools, because that's what gets people really upset. I mean, I think people, a lot of this culture war stuff, most people want to tune it out, But when it shows up in their kids' homework, when it's coming home from the kids in school, that's when they get engaged, and that's when they get really ticked off and they start showing up. So, you know, one of the things is, you know, we're paying the price for the fact that, have you ever been to a school board, a public school board meeting? I haven't, because my kids are in a private school, but I know people who have gone to those, and there's like 12 people there, right? So, you know, the most committed and fanatical people show up, and they run everything because everybody else is not showing up. Nobody pays any, everybody's focused on national level politics, and nobody pays attention to what, to the school board election in their own town. And it's, you know, when they do, that we just saw it last month in San Francisco, they had these super woke people who were, you know, renaming schools because Abraham Lincoln wasn't good enough for them. But they, you know, they were renaming schools that were still closed because they couldn't come up with a plan to open them after COVID, in, during the pandemic. And that's when parents finally got engaged and started actually voting and voted those guys out of office. So one of the solutions here is people need to actually focus on the elections they can actually control and show up for school board meetings. But the other aspect of it that I think is a model for this on schools is this makes the case for school choice and for saying, let's take more of this out of the hands of government. And you know, if government has less power, then it can, it has less power to impose whatever its fad agenda of the day is. And my concern is that for a lot of people on the right, the people I'm criticizing on the right, that's not really their goal. They don't want to take power away from government. They want to say, no, our people should be wielding that power on our behalf in favor of our ideas, instead of we should be, you know, reducing the power the government has to impose this on us in the first place.
Well, we'll go to Phil. Phil, I think, yes, you've got your mute button. Go ahead.
Okay. I think that Rob's principle, don't have government, bring government into the culture wars, fails to some extent if government is already in the culture war. In other words, I don't think the public schools are not they're not competitive, they're socialist institution. And so to some extent, you really do have, I mean, there already are state mandates in many states as to, you've got to teach, spend this much time on this issue, whether it be Black history or whether or not somebody is gay or what have you, and there's got to be this many tests, questions on it. So maybe one way in which state legislatures step in is to remove those mandates. But I don't think you can completely stay out of it. For example, suppose the 1619 Project, which the New York Times is promoting, ends up being mandated to be a part of the curriculum. In that case, maybe you want to mandate that there's an alternative book or whatever. But the problem is that can get too specific. And the problem with the Don't Say Gay law in my state of Florida is it says something reasonable, which is you shouldn't be teaching sex in K through three grades because it's not age appropriate, for one thing. But it's sort of a specific measure on a specific issue. Maybe the way to go, I mean, ultimately, you got to fight for privatization of the schools, sell all the schools to the highest bidder. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. So maybe what you need to do is fight for limited things that governments, the state legislatures can do. First of all, some measures to make sure that there's balance, that if you're going to teach the 1619 Project, fine, we don't want to censor that, but you have to teach an equally heavyweight alternative, something like that. And or maybe you mandate that the public schools have to have transparency. They can't sneak the 1619 Project in or these various things. They need to let people know. I mean, the parents don't always see in the homework what the kids are learning, but there needs to be some kind of transparency as to what, some kind of law or something that they report. How many hours do they spend on such and such? Which books do they cover? Do they cover any conservative books in economics as well as liberal and so on?
All right.
Those are a couple.
Yeah, those are good points. Go ahead,
Rob. I, that's a great point. So I'm way more sympathetic to this sort of transparency laws. that they basically say the bureaucrats have to reveal what the standards are. And I also think that we should have a lot fewer standards dictated down from the government. Now, how we got those standards is really tied in with the failure of the public schools. Because what happened is that if you don't have those standards, what happens is you have awful public schools, especially in the big cities, where the, you know, the teachers unions and corrupt local officials are running everything, you know, you get this situation, everybody who's lived in or near a big city knows this, where, you know, everybody who, if you really care about your kids' education, you move to the suburbs and you actually like go around figuring out what zip code do you need to move to in order to have decent public schools. Public schools are free, but in practice, people actually pay for public schools by the premium that you pay to buy a house in a neighborhood that, you know, that's in a town that or a district that has good schools, right? So you pay like an extra $100,000 in your house so that you can send your kid to a quote unquote free public school. Now, this is the reason, by the way, why I, despite not properly being able to afford it, why I've always sent my kids to private schools. Now, I'll talk about that in a second. You don't totally eliminate wokeness in the private schools. I find that in private schools, you tend to have a choice between you can send your kids to learn that they should be guilty, send the kids to a Catholic school so they should learn they should be guilty because they're sinners, or you send them to a more left leaning school where they learn to be guilty because they're not recycling or because of the history of slavery or whatever. I mean, you kind of have to choose your poison even among the private schools. So this is a cultural phenomenon that goes way beyond what the government is mandating. It has to do because it's a cultural trend. It's a cultural trend coming from deep ideological sources. So the government is sort of following the trend, not entirely making the trend. Now the government does, of course, encourage the trend, and there's a feedback loop there. And that's why I think that, so what happens with the public schools is because you have such terrible public schools, they try to solve it by saying, oh, we'll just have more restrictions coming down from the top down, dictating they have to cover this and they have to cover that, and this is exactly what the curriculum is going to be, and we don't just leave it up to the individual schools to decide, then we can somehow improve education. And of course, it never works, but that's how you get these things where you have, you know, detailed curriculum set at the state level, rather than, you know, the way it works in the private school system, where it's just each school gets to decide, you know, we're going to be a Montessori school and we're going to have this particular method and this particular curriculum. And you get to, you know, sort of set your own standards. So it's really a result, the fact that we have all these detailed standards being propagated from the top down, that's part of the problem in the first place. And it comes from the failure of the public schools to begin with. And the most heartening thing I've seen in recent years, and it's the perfect response to wokeness, though I think it's actually been a response to the pandemic, it has been a huge increase in school choice programs. You know, this was something that was this like, you know, wacky idea advocated by a handful of libertarians 30, 40 years ago. And now it's becoming very mainstream and has been widely adopted. And I think it's been made into law in a number of like a dozen different states by now, possibly more, where they have school choice system programs where, you know, you have a voucher or some sort of thing. And you can go decide what school you want to send your kids to. I think that, you know, that's far from being an unrealistic. For a long time, that was something you could dismiss and say, oh, well, that's kind of pie in the sky. We'll never get there. But I think it's actually becoming far more realistic now. Not that we're going to sell off the public schools, but that it make it easier for people to compete with the public schools. And I think that's actually becoming a much more realistic, I mean, it's actually happening a bunch of places, and it's becoming a much more realistic answer. It came out as an answer to COVID because the public schools really failed badly at, you know, being able to start themselves back up and come up with a safe way to teach the kids. But I think it's also a perfect answer to the whole wokeness thing, is let people send their kids to the Catholic school or the Protestant school or the super woke school, or what I think most of us want, which is the school that just teaches the three R's and lets people figure out their ideological preferences on their own. I think that's the answer we got to be advocating for.
Good. I'm going to invoke founder privilege and jump to Atlas Society founder David Kelly.
Thanks, Scott, and thanks, Rob. My question is actually was essentially the same as Phil's comment. So I just want to add one quick thing. There, I'm all for school choice. I've been following that movement for decades. And what's happening now because of the pandemic is very heartening. But public schools have been around for, you know, probably going on close to two centuries now in at the state and now the federal level. So I don't think we're going to get rid of them right away, although that would be the ideal, solve a ton of problems. But as long as we have them, and public schools are in the business of education, they have to have standards for what counts as education, what subjects to teach, and so forth. And Rob, I'm wondering if there is any kind of neutral principle, or more neutral principle than just opening it up to the ideologues on the right and the left that you described earlier. You know, I'm not sure this is a solvable problem because you think back to the Scopes trial 100 years ago.
Yeah.
About teaching evolution versus teaching, the biblical theory, which has raised its ugly head more recently than that. There are always going to be disputes about that. But my sense is that the public schools that educated the hordes of immigrants from Europe and elsewhere in the early part of the 20th century, rather, actually did a pretty good job in terms of, you know, as a teacher, I've read something about people pointed out high school graduates could write better than most college graduates today. and, you know, I'm as a writer myself, I'm very aware of that. So there was something that seemed a little better back then, and holds out the hope that until we can privatize education full court, are there ways that we can have, not get the government out of schools because we're talking about public schools, but have a more or less neutral standard or restrict the educational bureaucracy to standards that are clearly tied with education. That is to what a reasonable person needs to know in order to become an effective adult.
Well, I think that's a good point. But I think the bigger problem is the decay of education, to the extent that's happened, in the last century, I think partly has to do with simply the premises of government control of an organization working its way out. You know, that eventually when the government does something it shouldn't be doing, eventually that catches up to you. And so I think the declining quality is a result of that it becomes more over time, it just becomes more and more bureaucratized and by virtue of being bureaucratized, it becomes more and more captured by particular, cliques that come out of particular schools and that then have ideological have an ideological bias or an ideological commitment that then becomes universal. I mean, it happened with progressive education. It's happening with woke education and all of that. And this is, a lot of this actually happened years ago. It takes more time for it to thoroughly work its way out into the system. Oh, by the way, when doing some research on this, I found that there were huge fights in the 19th century when the first public school systems were created. Because when the first public school systems were created, they had a rule. Maybe this is partly an answer to your question, because this is a previous example. When the first public school systems were created, oftentimes the laws that created the state laws that created the public school systems mandated that it had to have religious instruction. Now, this is before, all the First Amendment, modern 20th century First Amendment challenges you would see to that. You know, America was mostly a Christian nation, so nobody really challenged that. But here's what happened. When they said you had to have religious instruction, a bunch of the Protestant, you know, it was mostly Protestant countries, so they would say, oh, well, so we have the King James Bible. And we'll have passages, kids reading passages from the King James translation of the Bible. And then a bunch of the Catholics objected and said, well, wait a minute, that's not our version of the Bible. That's a Protestant interpretation of the Bible. And a bunch of the Protestants said, you bet it is. You know, we're trying to stamp out this Catholicism. So the whole Protestant versus Catholic religious war, like you know, we were saying earlier, the culture war never goes away. In the 19th century, the culture war was Protestants versus Catholics. And this whole Protestant versus, there were like riots in Boston and court cases and, you know, just tremendous upheaval throughout, you know, over a period of decades throughout the 19th century over this fact of religious instruction in public school and it being used often purposely to be biased in favor of one religion and against one denomination and against another one. And the solution we eventually came to by some court cases in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, the solution we generally came to was not to have religious instruction in public schools, right? So there's, you're finding the neutral ground of saying, we're going to leave this outside of the schools. This will be left to parents at home to decide which denomination you're going to raise your kids in. And religion was sort of shoved out of the public schools and religious instruction was shoved out of them. And that was the neutral compromise that was come to. Now, you can't say we're not going to teach history in the schools. You have to teach history. But I think it is true that you can come to standards that are more neutral standards of history and that not standards that say you can't talk about X, but standards that say you cannot mandate that one particular interpretation be imposed on the kids. But like I said, the other wider the issue, though, is that all of these things, the fights over the public schools tend to be subsidiary to larger sort of social and philosophical trends, which are just being amplified when they go, when they become controversies for the public schools, they just get amplified. So I think that, you know, part of the solution here is you solve this on the wider cultural level and you do things like, you know, make these arguments about wokeness and, you know, and it, far from turning the cheek, you go mercilessly mock the 1619 Project by endlessly hammering on all of its distortions of history and its omitted facts and invented facts and all of that sort of thing. So I think, you know, that there's a tendency among politically obsessive types to always say, oh, there must be a government solution to this problem. And sometimes there isn't, you know, there isn't a really great government solution. There's certain laws that you might back, but the solution has ultimately got to be, you know, cultural solution to it.
All right. Well, Lawrence, thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
Thanks, Rob, for doing this. It's already sort of been touched upon already by what everyone else is asking or been talking about. But yeah, this whole question specifically about the whole government involved culturally when it comes to schools is always been this sort of more nebulous thing. I mean, you could argue, and as you said, you know, when it comes to culture, like Hollywood, well, we've got people sort of like over at the Daily Wire, they're more conservative, they're making films, movies, all that stuff. So you're seeing people naturally create alternatives in the culture war, so to speak. But when it comes to public school, it's that whole problem and sort of messy situation of it being government, to an extent, state government, federal government, and people saying we don't have a voice. But as you said, there's the PTA meetings, and yet we see people who go to these things seemingly kicked out. So I guess the big thing we should be really pushing for, I guess, at this point is just more privatization, because we could try to make change in the schools and try to become more active, but it seems like there's going to be a lot of barriers there. So is it better to keep fighting in those spheres or just not petition government to try to fix anything because of the repercussions it could have and just try to create more parallel infrastructure, more schools, right, and other alternatives?
Well, okay. So my own personal answer to this is I've got two kids and they're in private schools. And like I said, I can't properly afford it, but you know, we've also gotten more, my wife more so than me, has gotten very involved in, you know, volunteering and being involved in the decision-making processes. Because, you know, your typical small private school, you know, it's like most small organizations, small private organizations I've been to, the way to get involved and have an influence on it is to volunteer to do work. Because that's their, like, their number one. They always need somebody to volunteer to do something. Like, okay, we'll put you on a committee, and then you're in, and you have some influence over the organization, and keep it from going off the rails, or keep, you know, push it in your direction as much as is reasonable. And if you don't do that with a private school, so, you know, my predilection, because I'm a big believer in the Montessori method. I'm a big fan of it. So I went to the local Montessori school, and the public schools aren't doing that around here. There are some public Montessoris here around the country, but not here. But also, the thing you talk about, people showing up to the school board meetings and then having, you know, being described as domestic terrorists. And there were some people actually were threatening school board members. So that wasn't totally invented, like physically threatening them. But the thing is, if you go to the school board meeting and they scoff at you and they treat you badly and they treat you with contempt, my advice is go back to the school board meeting. Keep coming back to the school board meeting. Recruit your friends to go to the school board meeting, because ultimately those people do answer to the public. And I really encourage people to look at this thing that just happened in mid-February or late February, like February 20th or so, that they had a recall election. So what happened is, you had these super woke people, these three super woke types who were running the school board in San Francisco. Now, San Francisco is about as far left an enclave as you can find in the country. But a bunch of the parents there got fed up on it. And these were people who are not conservatives. They're not objectivists. They're just people who, you know, they're upper middle class tech people who highly value education and want their kids to be getting a good education. And they just rebelled and said, this has to, you guys, you people are incompetent. You're doing all this political grandstanding on wokeness instead of actually getting the schools open so my kids can learn. And they started this rebellion and organized a recall election. And like more people voted to recall the people than voted to put them in the first place, because nobody ever votes in these local elections. And they succeeded in changing it. Now, I don't know how much it's going to improve, because this is San Francisco after all, but it's certainly better than what they had. And that's a great example of how, even when they ignore you and they treat you with contempt, which the San Francisco school board people totally did to this movement, you know, you, the people, have the power if you get involved and do it. And I think one of my pet peeves is everything gets so federalized. A lot of this woke culture war stuff gets pushed up to the federal election and federal level, and we expect Donald Trump getting elected to solve it somehow. Whereas most of the actual stuff being done on it is happening at your school board meeting. So there's national level politicians love the woke stuff, because they get to posture endlessly without actually having to do anything about it, right? Because most of the decisions are not on the are not things they can directly affect. So congressmen love to do, you know, you see some of these guys out on Twitter, they love to do the anti-woke stuff. And it's just to pander to the voters. They're not actually accomplishing anything. Most of the stuff is going on. The most direct impact you can have is go to your local school board meeting. Go find out what, you know, who's being elected at the county, at the city and county level where you live. And so many people live on Twitter and they're totally invested in what's happening in the national politics. And they're totally ignoring what's happening, you know, in their own town and in their own county and in their own state. So that's one of the pet peeves I just want to rail against.
All right. Well, you're a pro getting us right to the top of the hour. This was a good topic. Rob, appreciate you sharing your thoughts. We could have gone longer. Tomorrow at 5 p.m., the Atlas Society asks Dorian Abbott on cancel culture. Plus Thursday, we're back here on Clubhouse. We have David Kelly at 4 p.m. Eastern talking about objectivity. And Thursday, Richard Salzman at 8 p.m. will be talking about how the war on fossil fuel fuels wars. Links at atlassociety.org. On behalf of the Atlas Society, I'm Scott Schiff. Thanks for joining us today. And Jennifer, feel free to chime in.
Yep, great job, and hope to see you guys tomorrow. It's going to be a great conversation with Professor Abbott.
Great, we're looking forward to it. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.